Les colloques du Collège de France.
All right, so I want to begin by thanking very much Lee and Adam and Philippe for organizing this conference. So I'm afraid my paper with Jacques may not be as terrific as some of the wonderful papers we've already had. It's sort of a small thing, but it has some interest and a little bit of memory of Svi in it too. Okay, now I've got to find the page down key. The keyboard defeats me. Let's try that. Yeah, that worked. Okay. The larger goal is, it's a little late to be starting a new research project, but this is work that I've done basically not at Max Planck, but with Max Planck. And the larger goal is this interest, long-term interest, in which Jacques and I have had, and originally with Paul David, but of course that's no longer possible, to investigate the performance of different ways of organizing research across countries. What has made this easier, of course, is OpenAlex and other things like it, which now makes it much more cost-effective to gather data on the careers of different scientists, especially for people like me who are cheap researchers as opposed to people with large budgets. This paper is really looking very closely at a small topic, which is the presence or absence of cumulative advantage in the presence of heterogeneous productivity of researchers. Now, it's not that other people haven't worked on it. It's more that we're able to get a more coherent, consistent set of data for this, much larger. The story, I love the quote from Small World. Morris Zapp, who is loosely modeled on a deconstructionist researcher in the US many years ago, basically states the cumulative advantage story pretty well David Lodge has written it. Morris Zapp is the character. When he's thinking about going to the Rockefeller Foundation at the Villa Serbelloni in Bellagio, which I will say Svi turned me on to, and he and I have both been there. It's quite a deal. You go for a month in this absolutely gorgeous spot, and you're supposed to do research and not go around and hike in the mountains and stuff like that, which is, of course, very tempting. But I won't read the whole quote, but you get the idea. It's the Matthew effect, okay? His description of the Matthew effect. So,
you haven't read that book.
It's a fantastic book.
You have to read that book.
And I will tell you that my children once pointed out to me that it was modeled on Orlando. It actually has a very long... because David Lodge is a professor of English and comparative literature, was a professor of English. He basically became a successful author, partly on the shoulders of that book. And you should read the preview book, too. There's a preview book about a Birmingham professor and a Berkeley professor changing places during the 60s when the differences between English education systems in university and Berkeley were at their greatest. It's very humorous. Anyway, to go back to the topic of this talk, the French research system in physics is what we're studying, and there are two main institutions. One is the Center for National I can't even translate it, Centre National de Recherche. I forget. This is a very centralized selection. It's highly competitive at entry, but after entry, the main competition would be how fast are you promoted to being a director of a lab. But other than that, it's a relatively guaranteed salary for research, although you might go out and get more money if you wanted to do something expensive, to support other purchases. You can teach, but it's not required. The universities are centralized to some extent. I mean, basically, the main point here is that we're not really doing a comparison the way we would like to, because we haven't looked at the U.S. or the U.K. or, you know, even Germany. Because in the university, as in Italy, the state-funded universities, which is most of it, have little competition across each other, which makes basically the prospect of raising your salary by moving is not really an option, which is the way people compete in the U.S. I'm unclear, and my co-authors answer any questions about what about those guys at the Grands Écoles and the industry. We're just not considering it. Now, the way we made our data was, this data's been around for a while, but I essentially recollected it because the original origin of the data, it wasn't entirely clear that it was complete, and at some point there was a dating problem, and there was just a number of things that I couldn't quite straighten out. So what you start with is something which we obtained, Jacques obtained from the CNRS, which was the names, the gender, the birth year, or some version of the birth year, for 3,300 French physicists, which is effectively a universe, collected in 2 years for the CNRS and in only 1 year for the university physicists. When we do any direct comparisons, we actually try to use only the 2005 list for the CNRS. So I took this to OpenAlex and got all the publications and citations to 2022 with the help of a wonderful guy at Max Planck, Eric Bunk, who actually did the scraping, you know, from the thing. I will tell you, okay, for those of you who are OpenAlex buffs, there is an important thing which you may or may not be aware of, because I found a researcher who was not aware of this recently. I talked to somebody about a month or two ago. In July 2023, they changed the ID numbers on every single physicist, okay? And that means that, you know, you've got to have it, when you use the data, you really have to either use a more recent set, or you have to not touch whatever you've already done, because it's really hard to match it. This matters because if you want to do co-authors, you need a consistent set, because this data does contain co-authors by ID. So you can see that we have the, you know, it's like the biblical 70%. This is, I don't know, the non-biblical 18 to 19% of women, you know, which we've seen before already in various other contexts in the academic area. But anyway, those are just the numbers, and it gives you the idea of what we get. We get very little. Cleaning doesn't lose very many people for CNRS. For the universities, it loses a lot more, partly because some people specialize in teaching, so they never show up with publications, and partly because you have to spend a lot of time with these women, okay? Because the list I have, I don't know if it's a married name or a not married name, and some of them do change their names. There's no question. If I do a lot of web searching, I can find them, and I haven't, and of course not all do, right? It depends on timing, you know. I change my name. Other people haven't changed their names, you know. And so I think with the universities, I have to do some more web searches. There may be a few more women that I can pick up. So to summarize the selectivity, the probability of being in the sample increases a little bit slowly with the birth year. Okay, more recent ones, I'm more likely to have found the data. For the CNRS, it does not depend on gender. There's no exit that is higher rate for the women. For the university physicists, the marginal effect of gender is fairly large, and I suspect the problems with surnames, but I also think that some of the women are specializing in teaching. I think it's more likely. The exit probability just says that it's lower for CNRS. They're less likely to stop doing research. When I mean exit, I mean I don't find publications and citations ever until, you know, after a certain point. Move on, I think. So the first thing we did, and this kind of goes back to the original instigation of this project by Jacques, was, you know, there are these stylized facts that float around about researchers. which is, you know, that the distribution of scientific productivity is extremely dispersed, and we know that. I mean, it's obvious. You look around you, you see that it is. And what we find is that it's not as extreme as some versions of Lotka's law in our data, which is not terribly surprising. I mean, some people say, you know, 80% produced by 20%. Well, this is more like 54% or 61% produced by 20%. The hierarchy remains stable during much of their lifetime. Well, yeah, sort of, but not really, really strongly. The corresponding concentration, this is the one I found the most surprising. The corresponding concentration tends to increase over time within scientific cohorts. Now, we think that's true. Because it's sort of an implication of the previous. but the by Gini coefficients, it's not true. It basically decreases over time rather than, you know, increasing. I'm going to stop doing this stuff because I don't think it turns out to be terribly informative, but it was, you know, it was interesting to, I spent a lot of time on it, trying to figure this out. I decided in the end it wasn't terribly productive. Highly cited papers are sites greater than 1,000. That's just arbitrary. I tried other numbers. It doesn't make any difference. It's kind of interesting. It's clear that these papers are not randomly assigned to physicists. Okay, that's clear. But by something, by not a lot. There are a lot more with one paper than you would have expected, one highly cited paper. That's sort of due to the fact that the only people in the sample are people with cited publications and citations. But when you go out to the very end, 4, 5, 6 cited papers, you have in the sample many more physicists with a series of highly cited papers than you do than you would have predicted if you randomly assigned those papers to the physicists. Okay, so that just says that, you know, there's skewness. It's harder to see with universities because there's only 3% with highly cited papers. Okay, so the real interest in this paper, or the thing that, you know, we eventually settled on, was an old question, and I told Heckman about this, Jim, about this, you know, the other day, and I'm sorry he's not here because this is a question he spent a great deal of time on, heterogeneity or state dependence. Well, I mean, one thing about having publications and citations instead of the unemployment status of an individual is you actually have quite a bit more information, so that helps a little. The stylized facts about that's a summary. Okay, so so what we did was conditional on the age quadratic. So you need to put some kind of age, some kind of thing that describes the fact that in principle this is true. I played a game thanks to a paper by I can't remember his name. He's more of a computer scientist than an economist. It's not someone you would know. He wrote a paper which he claimed that the model that lies behind what we did with the Poisson, which is essentially that each person has its own productivity, lambda I, and that your Poisson, once you've got that lambda I, your Poisson, okay, with that lambda I, it's a constant throughout your life. And that those lambdas are approximately gamma distributed, and you then convolute that, and that gives you the negative binomial out, and which is, you know, what we did and many other people have done. I mean, back to Yule and Greenwood, and God knows, you know, goes way back. So I experimented with that, but you can pretty clearly see that we have enough data, so we reject it. But it does look vaguely like negative binomial for pooled data, and it does look approximately gamma distributed. It's not all that far from it. It's certainly a better model than Pareto, log normal, lots of things like that. Okay, so the question about heterogeneity and state dependence, I then backed off from that and decided to do it via the regression approach. Observed heterogeneity is permanent differences in productivity Or, you know, the question is, does early success lead to more resources and time and therefore increased productivity as time goes by? We do not have resources, except for this idea that the CNRS people have better access than the universities to resources without, to guaranteed funding, I guess is the way to say it. So what we did was estimate fixed effect models that include lagged cumulative productivity, you know, but citations or publications. So that's the, you know, the model. The age of the year effects are in there. The time, the age effects are in there. Sometimes the gender effect is in there. Birth year and gender are time invariant and not identified in fixed effect models. And I'll say more about that. Have I got five? Okay. This isn't actually that long, so it should be okay. One thing you run up against is you're going to get different interpretations depending on whether you put age in or not, because age, year, calendar year, and cohort are collinear. So the fact that we use a quadratic in age means that we've got identification. Jacques and I and Laura Turner wrote a paper a long time ago doing this age, doing this collinear analysis in this context. It's not a new phenomenon, but it's a, we did it in this context. Okay, so we did OLS, Poisson with fixed effects, a negative binomial with fixed effects, and GMM on the first difference equation with lagged excess as instruments, which is the better way to do it. Okay, now the reason for this is it's clearly not Poisson, right? The whole thing, but negative binomial with fixed effects. Okay, it turns out, and it's something that's implicit in our paper of 1984, but it is not made clear by us, nor is it made clear in the Stata manual. Stata thinks they're doing a negative binomial fixed effect in the mean model, and they're not. They're doing our model, which is a fixed effect in the variance. And it means that gender is identified in the negative binomial fixed effect model that we know and love, or most of you probably don't love it, but or even know it. But it's what you know. If you say I want to do fixed effects in a negative binomial, you go to Stata and run that thing. You'll identify your time invariant variables. I assure you. In fact, you can identify the fixed effects. I tried that too. You can just stick all them in a bunch of dummies for each physicist, and you can identify them. Now, they might have big standard errors, but they're there. So what you're identifying is the variance. Now, I asked Jerry about this. He says he knew it. Well, I believe that. But I don't think Svi knew it, because when we ran the regressions, we did not, and I didn't know it. When we ran the regressions, we did not put the time invariant variables into the regression. And if you look at the paper, you will see that. I have since done that, and sure enough, they're identified. Just to warn you. So that's the warning in the connection. So no matter how highly cited a paper is, there's still something about it that's, you know. I should mention, there is a guy who's written a critique, which is published in Economics Letters, a guy named Guimaras, whom I do not know. But there's, you know, I wrote up a note, but then I discovered his note, so I decided, you know, to forget it. And actually, Paul Allison has done a much better job. He has a very good paper on this, pointing this out. But it's in sociology, so you'll never see it, you know. So the first thing to say is the cumulative advantage coefficients, it doesn't matter how you slice it, they're positive and reasonably big, 50%, you know, something like that. I need to finish, and so I will tell you what I then tried to do. To make life simple, I did this with the log model, the OLS log model, which is effectively equivalent to the Poisson at this point. And I computed the fraction of variance explained by individual effects and the fraction explained by cumulative publications. So this is a question of which one is more important, the effects of the state dependence or the heterogeneity in explaining the variance in people's output. I mean, that was the question. And of course, they're correlated. So it depends on the order in which they're computed. You can't really orthogonalize. It's very clear that the fixed effects have stronger explanatory power in these data. Yeah. So I highlight in green the addition of cumulative output. If you add it second, you get, it explains 1 to 1.5% of the variance. If you add it first, before you add a fixed effect, it explains about 9 to 8% of the output. The numbers for the university physicists are just tiny bit lower. This isn't the end of the story, but this is the basic story. Done in the easiest way you could do it. I may go back and try to do it with the GMM estimates, which are the ones that I would have more confidence in. To remind you that the advantage of GMM on the first difference model for these type of data and other types of data is you're no longer assuming strict exogeneity of the regressors, which is a fairly silly assumption if you've got lagged productivity in the regression. I'm done. It's ringing a bell. Okay. So I'll show you I show you some reservations, but there are many more. I stop.
Thanks a lot to the organizer for inviting me here, for giving me the opportunity to discuss this paper. I met Triglekas just once in my life, but I was here at the previous conference. It was for me a game-changing experience. I don't remember if it was at that conference or not, but I keep being hit by memories. So I don't know if it's that conference, but I remember speaking with Tim and Manuel in the room, presenting a paper that was mostly about trying to prove that your famous paper on localized noise spillover had an omitted variable, which was personal distance between people. Shitting me in my pants, waiting for a question by Manuel, it's Tim who asked me, why do you think that citations are a good proxy for diffusion? I don't know what to say, and I say, ask him. trying to go to the end. So, I got some similar feelings now, because I've been asked to discuss a paper which is a tough econometric paper, and I'm not the most skilled person in that field, so I will try to find an escape route. So, first, mind my affiliation, which is BSE, which stands for Bordeaux School of Economics. UMR stands for Unité Mixte de Recherche, which means mixed unity of research, and CNRS means that I am in a mixed unit of university and CNRS. I will come back to this later. The other point as a prologue is Cissé La France. It's very difficult to explain to the rest of the world, even to Italians. We are the proxies stuff. The paper I had, Brown and Jacques, was only about CNRS physicists, so there were no university people there in the version I read. I will comment just that. So it's about all we have seen, but about CNRS scientists. The description of CNRS scientists is that they are highly selected, tenured, full-time researchers, that's true, mostly working on CNRS lab directed by CNRS directors of research. That's not true, I will come back to it. Mostly funded via block grants rather than through competitive PI, project-based grants. Again, this is not exactly true. This will be my escape route to avoid commenting the econometrics, okay? Okay. So I don't go into all the details here you have already seen. There are basically two explicit questions in the paper. Well, actually three, but in the paper, in the presentation, there were more explicit questions, but in the paper there are just two. One is, does productivity of CNRS physics display some statistical property based on Mathieu effects, so Lotka-like distribution, and so on and so forth, and whether panel data regression of yearly productivity on cumulative advantage with or without fixed effect managed to catch this Mathieu effect. The quick answer are, stylized facts do not look like to hold very well, but we can recover something with the regression. In the regression, we see something in terms of this Mathieu effect. So I don't dare to comment that stuff. It's too hard for me, too tough for me. But I will try to make myself useful in any way, okay? Giving you the Italian insider knowledge of the French system, okay? So the hidden question that was not so hidden in the end in the presentation is this about funding? So, accepting that we find or we are looking for some Mathieu effect, some increasing returns to past productivity, what is the mechanism here? And the suggestion, the quote for Small World that you made point at this, because what Maurice Zapp says is, I got a good paper, the good paper gave me a grant, the grant gave me liberty, I get another grant, and so it's funding. But in the conclusion, you caution that CNRS scientists are a selected group with continuous research support that does not depend on the repeated acquisition of grant funds over the career. So in that case, you shouldn't find, if you believe that it's about funding, any cumulative mechanisms of this stuff. So the first, my first contribution, if it's not funding, what, since you find some of this? Then my other recommendation is to look better into the history and present condition of CNRS. And if I may, to generalize a bit this argument, we may be worth for all the American researchers here, do your job when you study Europe, because it's more interesting than you believe. It is full of changes. For example, I'm sorry Ben Jones is not here, but he exploited one of these changes in a paper on academic patenting. We don't have any more in the countries that have the professor privilege. That is a major change. Professor privilege is over. You can study the effect of abolishing the professor privilege. And many changes like this occurred everywhere. Italy now is a very different country than before. There is a competition between universities are autonomous. They own all their buildings. And there is almost 17% of the funding is based on publication by their researchers. When I had to negotiate it to quit and come to France, I simply pulled out of the system my publication, and the rector told me, okay, I give you 1 year leave paid, okay? Because otherwise they lose the money based on my publications. So it's pretty competitive. So what's going on with the CNRS? First, it's true that CNRS at the beginning was the institution you say, but since the 1980s, there's been a progressive policy of dilution and decentralization of CNRS. Dilution, decentralization away from Paris, and dilution within universities. Now, the main unit of research of CNRS are Unité Mixte de Recherche. So many of the university people you have work in the same lab with the CNRS people. And even of the sum of CNRS money is available for researchers like me who work. Actually, if you don't work in a Unité Mixte de Recherche, you are in a second division, you are in Ligue 2 of research in France. So this steady decline, this decision comes with a steady decline in block grant funding and recruitment, okay? So just to give you an idea, so this is an idea for researchers in CNRS. So these are the people working in this Unité Mixte de Recherche. And if you see, the number of CNRS people is stable, while the number of university people in this Unité Mixte de Recherche is increasing. Not much, because this is France, okay? So there is more and more blending, and the blending is playing in favor of universities. So there is just the other point in steady decline you can see, this is the recruitment of foreign and French researchers by CNRS, okay? If you sum the two lines, you see that there is a steady decline overall. Of course, the steady decline hit the French and not the foreigners, because there's plenty of Italians who want to come and work in France, okay? But overall, it's a decline. And actually, the last point I will make, this is just a very old stuff, but the stuff has progressed. You can read only the last line. Project funding for CNRS research was 9.8% in 2000. It was 23% in 2013. This means not block grants. This means funding, project-based funding, and it's keep increasing because there is a freeze on the budget from block grants. And basically, CNRS researchers are told, go and chase your grants. So this is more and more. So why I'm saying this? Because all these changes give you some better, maybe other testing opportunities of your search for Mathieu effect. So I got two in mind. One could be individual shocks. Now you have individual shocks because, for example, CNRS researchers are great chaser of ERC grants. So you, within CNRS, you may have people who got and who didn't get a CNRS ERC grant, and you can compare some of the results. And the other is, of course, you can compare distant cohorts, the cohorts of the CNRS you may have in mind when everything was coming from the block grants, and the more recent cohorts that have been recruited on in a situation with much bigger budget constraints. The type of work I have in mind, this was just to please members of the audience and actually have gone. I made all this effort for nothing. So Pierre Azoulay and Ben Jones, they made papers that are more on an experimental nature. In the case of Pierre, he was looking not for funding effect, but for pure reputation effect. So whether your past publication get more citation after you get a prize that put you into the limelight, or in the case of Ben was whether more senior member in a team are as damaged by retraction as the more junior members of the teams in terms of, again, their the future citation to their past publication. But if you are interested to grants, again, and I finish, there is this work published on PNAS quite recently about the effect of Dutch young researcher getting the so-called VENI grant, the first stage grants, on their subsequent grant acquisition, which is the VENI BDM Vici. So I think that within CNRS today, you have a lot of opportunities to do this type of micro work on top of the work I don't dare to comment. And just to finish, since I prepared the slides, I don't want to throw anything away. If you look at the budget, this is the budget. The budget of CNRS, the block grant, the part that you take for granted, is basically 87%, 90% is salaries. It doesn't cover research, it's just the salaries. So if you want to do research, you bloody need the grants. Unless, and then it's interesting again, last point, unless you are in a different sector of physics, because then it's a heterogeneity you can exploit. If you are working in astronomy or new particle physics, you are attached to lab which manage the big infrastructure of research, so you have the money for that. But you are if you are in physical chemistry or other stuff like this, you need to chase for grants, so you can make the comparison. Okay, that's all.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.